Hello and welcome back to Security Insights, the podcast that takes a deeper look at today's most important issues in cybersecurity and beyond. I'm Stephen Pritchard. Cybersecurity and geopolitical risk are more closely linked than ever. The lines between cybercrime, espionage, and nation-state attacks are blurring. Crime groups might work with the backing of a nation-state, or at least operate from a location where the state looks the other way. Critical infrastructure is increasingly vulnerable to cyberattack, and state actors are constantly probing for weaknesses. And intelligence agencies are targeting enterprises for intellectual property that could give their states a military or commercial advantage. Much of this isn't new, of course. What is new is the way that digitalization exposes much more of a business to cyber threats. The attack surface keeps growing. And yet, investing in cybersecurity is still often seen as just a cost. Our guest this week is Steve Durbin, CEO of the Information Security Forum. The ISF is a member organization that's been around for 35 years, and as Steve says, much has changed in that time. In fact, the cybersecurity landscape today is radically different to that of even 5 years ago, he says. I asked him what's driving these changes, and whether we really are now more at risk than at any time in the past.
I think we're in a very risky space, to be honest. The world of cyber, as we've said a few times already, you know, bears no resemblance to what it was like 35 years ago. I would say it bears very little resemblance to what it was like actually 5 years ago. And the reason I say that is that we are, you know, facing on a pretty much daily basis emerging global challenges in the realm of different cyber threats, which are increasingly complex. They're being driven by the advances in technology, the speed at which technology is changing. We still struggle with talent shortages in the cybersecurity space. And increasingly, we're having to manage a fairly complex cross-data, cross-border data flow challenge. So if you're a multinational, the way in which you're transferring data across borders is becoming increasingly more complicated because we're seeing regulation changing so much. You know, my hope had been that we would get to some form of consistency with regulation, at least in the major markets around the world. I don't see that happening. I don't see it happening anytime soon. Mainly, I think, because of the way in which the whole landscape has changed. And for me, the biggest change has been cyber. Didn't call it that, you know, 30 odd years ago. But cyber as we know it today does have the ability to provide competitive advantage to organizations. That wasn't the case in, back probably even 5 to 10 years as much, because it wasn't seen as being so much of a strategic priority. And cybersecurity is now a critical business issue. It's being discussed in boardrooms. That never used to happen. Board members actually do understand it. That certainly has been quite a difficult journey, and I don't think we've reached the end of that yet in terms of educating business leaders. But what it means is that cybersecurity must be integrated into the overall strategic decision-making that we conduct as businesses. And so it does have some form of competitive advantage if you get it right. If you get it wrong, of course, it also has some pretty horrible consequences. And that, for me, is one of the biggest changes that we've seen in the way in which security really has sort of come of age, if you want to call it that.
And that, if we were to oversimplify, perhaps necessarily oversimplify the concept, one of the things that's changed, certainly and changed quite quickly in the last few years, is the increasing digitalization of business and the fact that things that were previously done in the analog realm are now online and connected. And that just gives people plenty of more opportunity to disrupt what we now call cyber-based systems, cyber technologies.
That's absolutely right. And I don't see that changing in the future. If anything, I think it's going to get more complicated because we're starting to see things like AI coming into the workplace. It's not where it will end up yet, but it's starting to be used in a number of different fairly discrete spaces, not just in security, but also in other parts of the business. We've also got something called quantum that's looming on the horizon, which is going to change very significantly the security space. And that's just to name, you know, two that we can put our fingers on today, are things that are going to be more problematic in managing the emerging business landscape.
So if we think about the changes in the threat landscape and that broadening of the attack surface, so those two things working in lockstep, to what extent is geopolitics responsible for some of that, or driving some of that increase in threats?
It's an interesting question because, you know, I've been talking about geopolitics for probably about the last 6 to 8 years and the impact that it will have on security. And we're starting to see it really come to the fore now. Why do I say that? Well, we're starting to see a growing number of regional conflicts, of course, which impact not just the way that we conduct business on a day-to-day basis, but also things like our supply chains, where we get access to not just resources, but also hard materials that are required for a variety of businesses to go about doing what they do. And we're starting to see cyber gangs acting as proxies for some of the warring powers within those regional conflicts. We're also starting to see the emergence of governments understanding that perhaps they need to be a little bit more in control over what goes on in this particular space. And I would give two examples of that. If you look at what's gone on in the European Union recently with the EU AI Act, that's a very clear attempt to try to control in some way in which AI is being developed and therefore rolled out across Europe. If you look at the way in which it is being managed in, say, the United States, or even to a certain extent in the United Kingdom, it's a very different approach to it, mainly because in the US, certainly it's seen as being quite an opportunity to attract resource investment and something of the future. We're doing something similar in the UK in terms of trying to make it a little bit more attractive for organizations to come to the UK and to set up some of their development labs and research here. So we're starting to see governments understanding that actually this has the potential to be very big business, and how therefore do we attract that kind of investment. We're also, of course, starting to see things like social unrest arising. We saw some of that in the UK. We've got challenges related to migration in most parts of the Western world at the moment. And cyber has a role to play in all of that as well. Why are people heading to Europe, to the UK, and to the United States? Well, at a very simplistic level, for a better life. What does that look like? Well, it means more opportunity. Why are they moving? Some of it's down to climate change. Some of it is down to the fact there's much more opportunity and they're escaping some of the regional conflicts that I mentioned earlier. Now, all of that is being wrapped up in the way in which a business has to go about doing what it does best, which is serve the needs of its stakeholders, including their employees, as well as customers. And technology is pretty instrumental in the way in which most successful businesses do that today and will do it in the future. And if you've got anything to do with technology in your business, that means you've got a cyber challenge, and that means that you need to be cyber resilient. So it all comes together, and that's why geopolitics is becoming very much more important, because we've now understood that some of the things we've just been talking about are so key to the way in which businesses operate, so key to the way in which not just investment operates, but also economies, global economies. And cyber has the potential to be something of an Achilles heel if you don't get it right.
Is the geopolitical situation, or the changing geopolitical situation, one of the drivers of an increase in nation-state attacks against infrastructure, whether that's government infrastructure, private sector infrastructure, or indeed economic and social infrastructure?
Well, I think when we look at nation-state attacks, what we're talking about, I would say, is the modernization of good old-fashioned espionage in the main, and using that intelligence that is then gathered to either, you know, attack or indeed slow down your opposite number if indeed you're trying to steal a march on them. Now, that's been the same since, gosh, 17th century and earlier. The difference is that now you don't need to lurk around in corridors listening at doors. What you do now is you sit down in by all accounts, some fairly plush offices, and you sit at a keyboard and you conduct your espionage in that way. If you have the opportunity as a nation state cyber threat actor to slow down another country's development or to impact their national infrastructure or to influence their elections for your benefit, are you going to take that advantage? Of course you are. So all that's happened, I would say, is that we've modernized the spy game and we're using some very sophisticated tools now to be able to really understand how, as a particular nation state, we might be able to get one over our competitors and, of course, enemies if you happen to be at war.
What's the connection, though, between this espionage activity, which, again, is not even particularly new in the electronic sphere, it's been going on since the electronic sphere has existed, and more overtly criminal activity? So in particular, where we've seen the growth of ransomware, we've also seen the growth of organised crime groups backing ransomware, and they are operating at least with the tolerance of their host regime, if not the active backing of the nation state.
For me, there's two things in that. There's this money, filthy lucre. It's always been around. It will continue to be. And also the potential to use some of these gangs, as you've pointed out, for nation state backed attack. So it's a two-pronged thing there. You talk about organized crime getting involved in it. Yes, it's become very big business now. And if you look at the way in which, you know, cybercrime has evolved, it's now very big business. I've always talked about it as being hugely entrepreneurial. We're now at a point, of course, where you can have ransomware as a service. So gone are the days where if you're embarking on a career in cybercrime, you have to struggle to start making some money. You can go on the dark web, you can download, buy ransomware as a service, and you can try your luck. You'll be supported along the way. There are 24-hour support lines. There's training involved. And you can have a pretty good look at what the reviews are on the different packages that are available on the dark web. So it's an entire industry that's been set up. So the amount of skill that is being pulled together in these criminal gangs, of course, are going to want to be used by nation states if they can get their hands on them. And if you provide a safe haven to some of these cyber criminals, the quid pro quo is going to be that when the time comes, you may be called upon to help out, whatever that looks like.
But do you think this is tripping over into something a bit more sinister? Are we seeing something that's more than a series of isolated incidents, a series of high profile, say, ransomware attacks or DDoS attacks against high profile targets?
I think that what we've got evolving is something akin to the old Cold War. On the one side, you've got a set of skills, and on the opposing side, you've got a different set of skills. And so, yes, of course, the two are testing each other on an ongoing basis, and occasionally things will flare up that are of significant interest. So elections, if we're looking at nation state type things, elections are a very tasty opportunity to try to put out some disinformation around a particular candidate, because one candidate may be more suitable to one nation than another. And so influencing in some way, shape or form, the way that elections tend to run has been happening now for quite some while. And we're aware of that. Everybody's aware of it within a government environment. And so I think if you look at the state of defense, if you like, from that sort of Cold War perspective in cyber, we've got some very sophisticated systems that are constantly monitoring. And I see that increasing. Is it any different? Probably not. I mean, some people listening to this may well think that I'm being quite sort of blasé about it. But I have come to the conclusion after, looking at this now for what seems like a lifetime, but it's only been 15 years that I've been in the ISF. I've come to the conclusion that there are so many things out there that if you really want to get worried and upset about, you'd never really sleep at night. And so without appearing blasé, what I am saying is, yes, all of these things are evolving. All of these things are based around the way in which technology is changing. There are opportunities out there for good and bad, and our government agencies that are set up, irrespective of where they might be, to try to protect nation states are obviously working exceptionally hard to ward off some of the things that we've just been talking about. In much the same way, they too are also carrying out their own investigations and their own probes of opposing nations to see what stage they're at as well. And I think that's just the evolution of it. Now, where is all of that going to end up? We'll have to wait and see. I think that again, you know, one of the things you said was about the overt use. We don't see a lot of that. You wouldn't expect to see a lot of that because people don't talk about it. But is it happening on an ongoing basis? Of course it is. And will it continue and will it increase? Of course it will. And if you happen to be an enterprise that is operating in a critical national infrastructure space, then things are going to get more complicated for you. And that's why we see, if we just take one example, banks, for instance, collaborating very much more now, and they've always been very good at it, but very much more now to try to combat some of these emerging threats and share some of that threat intelligence. And I don't see that going away either.
We can dissect this in a couple of different ways as well. So, yes, we can talk, and we'll come back to it in a moment, the distinctions that exist between governmental organisations and private sector organisations. But before we get into that, you have this network of members and they feed data into you. So you've got a pretty good picture and a pretty geographically comprehensive picture of the cyber threat landscape at the moment. Now, are you picking up any different signs around the most prevalent types of attacks? And indeed, within those attacks, which are the ones that you see as causing the most harm to the organizations that you work with?
Yeah, some of these things are have been around for a while, will be around for a long while to come. So I'm thinking about things like phishing, for instance. We continue to see that. What have we seen that's changed? Well, we've seen it become a little bit more sophisticated, particularly with the rudimentary use of things like artificial intelligence. We've seen deepfakes starting to become very realistic and starting to find their way in. Ransomware, of course, continues to be a challenge for organizations. Denial of service attacks, of course, they're trying to combat those on an ongoing basis. But what organizations seem to be more concerned about, particularly more recently, is just the understanding, I suppose, of the fragility of the supply chain. And that hasn't necessarily come about through cyber gangs attacking. It's come about through things like the war in Ukraine, the war in the Middle East, some of the tensions in the Far East, particularly around Taiwan, for instance, with China. And that has started to focus some of our members' minds, depending, of course, on what their exposure is in these different areas, because they're concerned about that bleeding over into the cyberspace. So we've got, you know, the reliable old attacks that we're going to continue seeing, and that's in the phishing space, for instance. We've got some emerging stuff in terms of more sophistication around deepfakes, and then we've got this supply chain issue which is out there. And when we look forward, what are people concerned about? Well, from a government standpoint, the whole issue around quantum is something that is giving cause for concern, because there's a concern that the theft of data, you know, the downloading of massive amounts of information by criminal gangs and stored so that they can perhaps unlock some of that gold, crown jewels, at a point when quantum comes to pass. That's a concern. Also concerned about things like the combination of different elements of malware, with AI driving that development. So again, you know, organizations having to find themselves defending against very highly sophisticated and scalable attacks that could expose their data, AI fighting AI, that sort of thing. And there are very few organizations in the world that have the resources, I'm talking about people and money, to be able to address some of these things on their own. And that's why we're seeing more collaboration. That's why we're seeing a lot more public-private partnerships, if you like, government and private sector starting to combine in these sorts of areas. But not a lot has, you know, at the if you want to call it the basic level of cyber concern, not a huge amount is changing. There's also a little bit of a realization that the investment that we've made in technology to try to make life easier hasn't really delivered, and that the key perhaps to us being able to be a little bit more secure and resilient in our organizations continues to be and will be our people. And it's the way in which our people work collaboratively with the technology, whether that be AI, quantum, or whatever you like, that is really going to start to differentiate the way in which an organization is able to sustain some of the challenges that are going to be coming down the road.
The collaboration point is a very interesting one. And actually, you mentioned banking just before, but there's other sectors as well where you can look at it again from two angles. One is the possibility of a deliberate attack against parts of this infrastructure and the impact that's going to have on the economy and society. The other aspect of it is where enterprises are caught up in some other form of cyber attack or indeed cyber incident. They may not be the deliberate target, but their failure has knock-on effects, downstream consequences. How many societies could survive an attack on the healthcare system, an attack on the financial system, an attack on the electricity system? Not many, and not for long. Is that something that your members are concerned about, in particular that collateral damage, that they may not be the intended target, but they could be taken out, or indeed they could have a systems failure, which has that knock-on consequence where something as innocuous as a software update can wipe out, you know, big swathes of the economy in seconds?
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And I think that as we become much more dependent upon technology, then that is, you know, going to continue to be a particular challenge. So are our members concerned about it? Yes, of course they are. You know, if they're working in critical national infrastructure, whether they be in the health service, we have a number of members in that particular space around the world, whether they work in electricity supply and generation, again, similarly, and the banks, the financial institutions, you know, our membership spreads right the way across all of that. So, of course, they are concerned. What can they do about it? Well, what we've seen is that looking at it very much more from a risk perspective. You know, how do we manage the risk in this space? And that starts with understanding how long you can afford for your systems to be offline, to be down. And in some instances, of course, that amount of time is very, very small. In others, you can live for a little bit longer without it. And so what we've been encouraging our members to do is to look at it much more from the perspective of protecting the crown jewels. And how to do that. So, you know, if you have some fundamentally business critical infrastructure that you cannot afford to have offline for more than, say, seconds or minutes, then that's where you need to be putting all of your attention and your focus on day one. You don't want to be cutting corners in that particular area. And so what we're seeing is a lot more members adopting that kind of focused approach that says, okay, we need to be more resilient in this space. Where do we start? Let's be realistic about it. We're not going to be able to protect the whole real estate because, as you rightly point out, the way in which we currently do business is it's absolutely impossible to protect all of the different third parties that we're engaged with in terms of transacting business these days. And they may be the way in which an attack comes in, and we may be detrimentally impacted by that. But let's look at how we can protect what is really important to us first, and then gradually extend the perimeter from there. But there will be some systems that some will say, okay, if it goes down, it goes down. You know, it's a best endeavors thing. Of course, we'll do all of the right things in terms of maintaining backups, in terms of maintaining support, but it's not going to get priority attention. Because it's not going to bring our business down. It's not going to impact, again, back to national infrastructure, the way in which we deliver service to society.
We've certainly seen a shift towards, or a shift back towards, more attention being paid to resilience and recovery. So it became a bit unfashionable, perhaps, as organizations started to move to the cloud. But would you say it's a fair observation that CIOs and CISOs are now much more aware of that? You know, we can't beat every attack, so we need to be able to recover from the one that gets through.
I think that's absolutely right, Stephen. I mean, I think that, you know, we perhaps bought into some of the technology vendors' stories about how good their systems were going to be in terms of protecting our businesses, and we spent a tremendous amount of money on that, only to realize that actually there is no such thing as 100% security. And so we have to fall back and spend much more time thinking about the recovery piece of that and how we can increase the resilience of our systems. And that's the sort of conversation that that a lot of our members are having, certainly with us, but not just with us, in terms of how they go about doing that. Because it's very easy for me and you to sit here and say, yes, of course, that's what they need to be focused on. But unpicking, you know, organizational constructs, particularly, as you mentioned, the cloud, third parties, where data sits, how it's moved across borders, all of that sort of thing. It's a massive job.
But lastly, just to come back to where we started with the question of geopolitics, we haven't as yet seen a declared cyber war. We've seen some elements that have come close. Do you think we could cross that threshold? Is there a reason why perhaps as yet we haven't? And what might be the consequences if we did, and particularly again for the enterprise, because the enterprise is likely to be caught in the crossfire, but they still need to provide those vital services we've talked about?
We haven't seen it yet. We have seen, of course, lots of examples where cyber espionage has been used to inform more traditional warfare. I mean, that's happening on a regular basis in the Ukraine. It's happening on a regular basis in the Middle East. And that will continue. I don't see that ceasing at any point in the future. I think when we talk about, you know, cyber going head to head with cyber overtly, then we're moving to a very, very dark place in terms of the way in which the world is going to have to deal with that. Because that, for me, is almost the nuclear option. The impact, for instance, of knocking out an electricity grid in the UK, to just build on the point that you were making, is not insignificant, particularly if we are moving, as it would seem that we are, to have much more dependence upon electricity for driving our cars and you know, just powering our homes, everything. So that piece of the economy is going to become very much more of a target. And that is of concern, clearly, from a critical national infrastructure protection point of view. And so attacking in that way can have a very large impact on society. And I think that's really where some of these bad actors, nation state back, would want to try to go. You know, you're not necessarily going to want to roll in the tanks to some of these places. You can achieve a huge amount simply by disrupting the way in which society operates and creating absolute chaos and mayhem. And that is probably more of a concern. And that's why we're seeing so much effort going into trying to have sophisticated counter-espionage techniques using cyber. That's why we're investing so much, you know, from a government standpoint, irrespective of where you happen to be in the world, because we have to try to focus on strengthening our ability to cope with uncertainty rather than, I think, sitting back and you know, trying to predict the future, because we simply don't know where some of these attacks might come from. But they would be very significant. Some might say cataclysmic. And I think that that's probably why we haven't seen some of them just yet. So I think that we'll continue to see them operating in the background. And some of that is purely down as well to the effectiveness of the defensive systems that a lot of our governments and nation states have put in place.
Steve Durbin of the Information Security Forum on how we're depending more and more on connected infrastructure and the opportunities that presents to bad actors. And both the public and private sector need to be ready to deal with greater uncertainty and to continue to invest in cyber defence. That, though, is all for this episode. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time when we'll look at the issue of stress in cybersecurity and what we can do about it. Until then, do catch up on past programmes on the website, securityinsights.co.uk, or subscribe and rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google, Amazon, and Spotify. Thanks again for listening.